and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am here for a special extra edition of our podcast this week to talk about the historic election in Hungary. I am joined by my Bruegel colleagues, Zsolt Darvas and Heather Graby. We are going to talk all about the economic consequences of Péter Magyar's historic win in this election against Viktor Orban, who had been prime minister for 16 years. He lost in a landslide. We had close to 80% turnout of Hungarian voters. There is so much to talk about. This is such a big moment. Zsolt, how did this happen and what does it mean?
Mr. Orban has been in power for 16 years. And when they came into power for the next election, they changed the electoral law, which strongly favors the dominant party, because more than half of the seats in the parliament are decided in individual constituencies, with the winner taking the seat. And since Mr. Orban's party, Fidesz, was a strong party, and the opposition was very divided among many smaller parties, basically Mr. Orban was always able to collect almost all individual seats. But this time, there was a major change, because under Péter Magyar, his new party, Tisza Party, which was just formed 2 years ago, was able to gather momentum, also partly due to really, you know, shocking scandals, not just for corruption, but in many other fields, which I think also has challenged the loyalty of former Fidesz voters. For example, there was a case when the Hungarian president pardoned a pedophile helper secretly, so it was not made public, and it was very accidental that it became public. And then, you know, everyone on being in the opposition or on the Fidesz side were really shocked, and this, I mean, scandal led to the dismissal or resignation of the Hungarian president. And there were a couple of other scandals which I think all suggested, beyond the numerous corruption cases, that a large share of Hungarian population believe that it is indeed high time to change the government. And at the same time, also the economic conditions of the country has been very poor. There has been practically no economic growth over the past 3 years. Why, for example, if you look at consumption per capita, measured at comparable purchasing power parity standards, then Hungary has the lowest rate among all 27 European Union countries. Even countries like Bulgaria and Romania, which started at a much poorer level, overtook Hungary. So I think there were many, many reasons. And due to the emergence of Tisza as a challenger of Orban, basically the electoral system this time helped Tisza against Orban, because of these 106 constituencies, Tisza won more than 80 or 90 of them, while Mr. Orban's party just won, I think, 13. So this has helped to turn Tisza's leadership in the opinion polls to an absolute majority in the parliament. More than two-thirds of the seats will belong to Tisza party. And this will provide them a majority to change the constitutions and other laws requiring such a large majority.
So you mentioned Hungary's really depressing economic performance compared to its EU peers, you know, the shorter lifespans, the lower measures. How did that economic frustration boil over, where some of these political concerns about rule of law, about Ukraine, about the EU funds didn't seem to get through the voters? Do you think it was really just they were tired of falling behind?
There are many factors, and in my personal opinion, obviously I didn't do a research by myself, the very poor conditions of the large segment of the society has also played a very important role. But there are also, for example, the campaign were really two contrasting campaign promises or messages. You know, Péter Magyar and Tisza party offered that if we get to power, we will do, you know, social justice, get back corrupted money to the state, restore the checks and balances for a proper functioning of the public institutions, restore full media freedom, including in public media. They promise tax cuts for the poorest segments of the society, pension increases for the poorest pensioners, and so on. So they offer a kind of a quite normal, you know, European way of policymaking in the country. In contrast, the campaign message of Mr. Orbán and his party Fidesz was a single message: war or peace. So they try to convince the electorate that if Mr. Orbán stays in power, then Hungary will remain in peace. If Tisza will win, then Hungary will join the war in Ukraine. Hungarian soldiers will be sent to Ukraine, they will be killed there, and also in other ways, you know, Hungary will be in conflict and suffer from the war. And I also think that many people simply didn't believe that, I mean, that this can be the case. They had similar rhetoric 4 years ago in 2022, but at that time, the Ukraine war has just started. You know, it started in February, elections were in April, and that time it might have been, you know, a bit more appealing, this war or peace narrative. But also at that time, there was no single united opposition party. Instead, five different parties formed a coalition from the right to the left side, which were also sometimes, you know, disagreeing with each other. And few people believed that these very different parties would be able to govern the country. So in 2012, this rhetoric worked well. But in this year, after 4 years of war, with, you know, Hungary, no involvement, and no involvement in any EU country, because no EU country was involved in a war, I think also this message largely discredited Mr. Orbán and many of his previous voters, I think, simply didn't believe that he is right, that Hungary would enter a war if Mr. Orbán loses his power.
Heather, you have a lot of experience working in this part of Europe. Tell us about the historic events and also why Ukraine was such a flashpoint. One would think that Hungary might be more domestically minded, but the conflict in Ukraine, of course, has been something that Viktor Orbán has been very outspoken about and obstructionist about at the European level, and something that seems to have had a big, made a big impression on Hungarian voters.
He made it a huge campaign issue, as Zsolt was just saying, in 2022, just after the war began, when he made all kinds of claims that there was a risk that there would immediately be troop call up in the EU itself. But he also for many years, had a pro-Russian stance. And there had been Russian involvement in the Hungarian economy for many years as well. So the kind of pro-Russian tilt that he'd followed logically made it then an anti-Ukrainian thing once the war began. Then there's also the factor of Orbán has, for all of his political career, made a lot out of the rights of Hungarian speakers, ethnic Hungarians in surrounding countries, including Ukraine. And he's repeatedly claimed that Hungarians in Ukraine, ethnic Hungarians in Ukraine, were being discriminated against and that they should be better treated. He's made a lot of political hay out of that particular issue. So there were a number of different factors there. And also, I think we should bear in mind that we were, you know, already mentioning the issue of corruption, that the relationship between Hungary and Russia, even before the war in Ukraine began, was one of many, many dodgy deals, many untransparent public sector contracts where the Russians were involved in refurbishing power plants, you know, the nuclear plant, for example, Paks 2, as well as other deals, which the EU criticized, which the Commission criticized, that they said, look, we need to know what's in these deals. You need to make the contracts public under the state aid rules of the EU. And Orbán refused to do so. So there's a very long-standing, not only rhetorical support of Putin and of Russia, but also a very deep financial relationship, which was clearly beneficial to Orbán and his government.
It's incredible. So, how quickly can we expect things to change? When does the new government take office, and how long do they have before another election is staring them in the face?
The final results are expected on the 4th of May. There could be some small changes because votes casted outside the country in embassies, and there are also some letter votes. They will be added to those already counted within the country. This would not change, so that nobody expects any major change to the results available as of now. And then the Hungarian president has 1 month to call for the new parliament, first convention, and then he must propose a new prime minister. So in principle, this process has to end by the 12th of May. It could be a bit earlier because if, again, the final results are confirmed on the 4th of May, then in principle it could be a few days after that. But even in the worst case, it could be on the 12th of May, after which the government can be formed relatively quickly. So by the middle or the second half of May, the new government would be able to form, again, in an ideal scenario. There are obviously also some, unlikely scenarios which could derail or delay this process. But in the baseline and most likely case, this is going to happen. And also, not surprisingly, Péter Magyar already requested the president to appoint him as fast as possible, because he would like to start working immediately. There is also another concern that in principle, the parliament would go to a summer recess on the 15th of June, which would mean that there will be just about 1 month for the new parliament to start legislating initial measures. It's also a possibility that, they will pass a special legislation which would allow the parliament to work longer and start the summer recess later, which I would expect because I see lots of energy on the side of the winning party to indeed start to implement their program as soon as possible.
How quickly could we expect to see the end of the Hungarian veto on things like the loan to Ukraine?
This will very likely end. The electoral program and also the first speeches of Péter Magyar after his election very clearly stated that they want to have good relations with all neighboring countries, and this also includes Ukraine. And they also said that they want to reestablish Hungary as a reliable member of the European Union. Now, our listeners might know that Hungary already obtained an exception for contributing to the loan in case Ukraine defaults. So Mr. Orbán, not letting this loan going through was just, made for domestic political reasons. Now, Mr. Magyar said that Hungary's dire fiscal accounts wouldn't allow it to change its position. So he will not rush to take full responsibility of the loan. But, just letting the loan go through without Hungarian contribution, I think it's very, very likely.
And you think it could happen fairly quickly? We saw after the Polish election where there was a new government that was very pro-European, but also some holdovers. And in the end, it took a few months, but not as long as some people feared, for Poland to start realigning with the EU. Would we expect something similar here?
The new government will be very aware that a key litmus test for the whole EU in seeing how pro-European this government will be is letting the Ukraine loan go through. And as Zsolt just explained, the terms under which it was agreed already gives Hungary all kinds of safeguards as regards potential default and so on. So I suspect that will go through quite quickly. But it's going to be a difficult set of issues in terms of how fast Ukraine might actually proceed also in its negotiations for EU accession. That's another issue. And there, Modjar has already said he wants to keep the veto, the national veto, and not move towards qualified majority voting. And he's also said that he wants to ask for a national referendum in Hungary before Ukraine could join. So he's throwing up some obstacles. And of course, other member states will be happy to hide behind Hungarian caution on this. And if you look across Central Europe, countries have quite a lot of different positions. So you've got Poland and the Czech Republic who want a clear path forward, maybe a date for Ukraine to join. You've got Slovakia, which is more cautious, and Fico, the Slovak prime minister, having a much more pro-Russian stance. And so this issue, so I think this stance from Modjar of we're going to keep national control of the process is likely to persist. But in terms of immediate support to Ukraine, financial support, I think that will go ahead. But remember also that Anita Orban, who's going to be the new foreign minister, no relation, by the way, of Viktor Orban, but she has said during the campaign that Hungary will not supply weapons, Hungarian weapons or troops to Ukraine. She's rejected a pro-Russian stance, but it's still not a very warm and fuzzy relationship with Ukraine. And of course, the other very big issue that comes up with Ukraine and Russia is energy, which we haven't talked about yet, where Tisa in the election campaign portrayed energy as a key security issue. They argued for energy efficiency, phasing out energy dependence on Russia by 2035, which is way, way beyond the overall EU deadline for phasing out energy dependence on Russia. But also they've talked about diversification, increasing renewables, storage, and so on. So that could help a lot with building more shared infrastructure across Central Europe. But it could mean that Modjar comes back to this issue of the Druzhba oil pipeline, which was damaged which Hungary and others have been asking for the oil supplies to be restored, especially now with the Iran crisis going on. So energy is still going to be a tricky issue.
Thank you for that. In the second half of our podcast, I'd like to talk more about really some of the economic after effects of all of this. Zsolt, you have written a wonderful first glance that I hope everyone who listens to this will read that walks through the budget constraints that the TISA government is going to be facing, as well as some of the key economic aspects of their platform. One of the things you mentioned is Hungary joining the euro. So how would that restart and how quickly could it happen?
The Orban government and also the central bank previous leadership were extremely against joining the euro. They said they tried to present some economic rationale for that. But in my own research, which was also published in various Bruegel reports, I largely disagreed with their conclusions. And my personal opinion was that it was more a political reason not aiming for a euro membership, because that would, mean centralizing an important economic power. And, this didn't, bode well with the government, which claims that they want to have independence from everything, including from the European Union. Now, the program of Mr. Magyar and his party is very clear that they want to achieve the conditions and to meet the conditions for euro membership by the end of 2030, so basically in 4 years from now. Our listeners probably know that in order to achieve that, the budget deficit has to be below 3%, which is currently over 5, and might be even higher if a fiscal consolidation would not be implemented by the new government. The public debt has to be either below 60% of GDP or have a sufficient decline towards that level. Currently, it is 74. Also, inflation has to be relatively low, and also the interest rate has to be low. Moreover, the country has to join the exchange rate mechanism of the European Union for at least 2 years. And since the banking union exists, also the Hungarian banking system would have to join the banking union before joining the euro. So there are many, many things to achieve. but at least they set a date by when they would like to reach this goal. And I think that also based on the market reactions, which were extremely positive, even in the week before the elections, the currency, the Hungarian forint, started to gain values relative to the euro. Stock prices started to increase. But after the election, you know, stock prices skyrocketed by almost 10% and the currency strengthened further. And I interpret this very positive market assessment of the election result as, you know, as a reflection of some trust that indeed the euro project might also go through, and indeed the new government will be really serious about joining the euro.
It's very exciting. We have an event at Bruegel coming up on May the 6th as part of our Finance Focus series. Nicolas Véran will be speaking with Hungarian finance professor Julia Kirai about this very topic. So listeners, please check in on that. And we will also link to Zsolt's previous work in the show notes as well. Heather, you mentioned energy before. Hungary has been one of the countries most determined to keep fossil fuel ties with Russia after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. How disruptive has that been for Europe's efforts to change course? And what happens now?
So Hungary's position has been disruptive, but that's not only because of Hungary itself. You know, it's a relatively small economy in Europe. It's only 8 million people. But it's been more the way that Viktor Orban was a leader of the opposition from other countries that didn't want to cut off their dependence on Russian energy, notably Slovakia. There were also others who kind of hid behind the Hungarian stance. So I think the pressure to move towards now a lot more investment in renewables, and we see that across Europe, of course, because of the energy crisis that's going on now. But energy is just one of many issues on which Orban defied not only the EU consensus, but also EU law on many occasions. And he set precedents for behavior as an EU member state, which I think will reverberate across the EU and provide a playbook for other would-be populist leaders for quite a long time to come. He didn't invent the practice of defying EU law and then daring Brussels to complain about it. You know, we could argue Silvio Berlusconi started that practice in the 1990s when he went after judges and tried to dismantle rule of law checks and didn't apply EU law properly in Italy. But Orban really perfected an incredible playbook of finding loopholes in EU law and loopholes in EU practices, which allowed him to get away with a lot of corruption, including misuse of EU funds, which in the end, the EU leaders, after 10 years of this, finally took action against that by putting conditionality on the use of some EU funds. But also the way that he defied EU law and then basically dared the Commission to issue infringement proceedings against him. And they were very reluctant to do that for a long time. For example, after the 2015-16 crisis on migration, he defied EU law on asylum. That's a pending issue, which is still one of the conditions for releasing the funds that are frozen in the EU budget, which should have gone to Hungary, but which are frozen. There are many conditions attached to those, which Zsolt has written about. But also, there are plenty of other ways in which he put forward, for example, a higher education law, which discriminated against foreign universities, notably the Central European University, which in the end was forced out. That was an extraordinary precedent for a university to be forced out of a European country for the first time since the Second World War. And also anti-NGO laws, which were similar to those in Russia, Turkey, and Egypt. So this kind of playbook where you have he went after soft EU law, where it wasn't evident that there was a clear breach under single market rules. In the end, there were some, for example, freedom to supply educational services. But he went for areas, the sort of soft underbelly of EU laws, which are a bit vaguer because they're not about the single market and economic integration, and where it's harder to win for the Commission to win a case in the Court of Justice of the European Union. In the end, that happened. husband, but it was such a slow process that he was able to move fast and furiously and dare the EU. So others could try that. Some of them have done. They haven't been as successful because he had incredibly clever lawyers, many of them trained during the EU accession process in EU law. But it has provided a kind of list of loopholes in EU law, which have fundamentally affected the way that even single market rules have been applied in some areas. And that will have an effect beyond his premiership. The most important thing for the single market is the way that Orbán took over the judiciary. And that also was then done later by the Law and Justice Party in Poland, who started taking over the courts, forcibly retiring judges, putting in their own appointees as prosecutors and judges and so on. And we see how long it took for the Tusk government, Civic Platform government, to start trying to dismantle the state capture of the judiciary, or executive capture of the judiciary. Magyar will face many of the same problems. And that is a problem for the whole of the EU. That's not a specifically domestic issue. Because if foreign companies can't get a fair hearing in a Hungarian court, then without, you know, being friendly with the ruling party and so on, that tilts the level playing field in the single market. It leads to corruption, but it also leads to problems with discrimination against foreign companies. So those are issues which really affect the European economy. Even if Hungary is not a huge part of it, it's a very important part of supply chains that run across Europe, for example, the auto industry and so on. And that's why I think there will be a lot of pressure on Peter Magyar now to meet the conditions set by the EU on judicial independence, as well as media freedom and so on, in order to release the funds that are currently frozen.
Jolt, in your piece, you mentioned not only these past conflicts, but also the possibility of a collision with the EU's budget rules. It seems like the EU and Hungary have got each other coming and going. What's your take on all of it?
Hungary has an excessive deficit in the definition of European Union treaties, meaning that it obtained a binding recommendation from the European Council on how the budget trajectory should evolve to end that excessive deficit. And the country is grossly off track. Last December, the Fiscal Council of Hungary, which, by the way, composed of three people who were appointed by Mr. Orbán, but apparently they made a very careful job and documented that 1.7% of GDP, so almost 2% of GDP, fiscal adjustment would be needed to comply with European fiscal rules. And this assessment was made in December last year. Since then, the fiscal situation became much worse. For example, just by February, the budget deficit in January and February, in the first 2 months of the year, accounted for almost one half of the total budget deficit planned for the whole year of 2026, largely due to additional pre-election spending. I mean, the Orbán government tried to make some additional sweeteners for everyone, car owners and everyone. So quite likely an even much more larger than 2% fiscal adjustment would be needed to comply with EU fiscal rules. And this is important not only for macroeconomic stability, because clearly, you know, with a large budget deficit and a rising public debt to GDP ratio, the fiscal situation can be much more unstable. Credit rating agencies might downgrade the country into junk category. For many rating agencies, Hungary is just one level above the junk category. So not just important for macroeconomic and financial stability, but also important from the perspective of EU structural funds, because in the current multi-annual financial framework, if a country fails to address the excessive deficit recommendation, then a suspension of EU funds is very likely. The Commission will have no choice but to make a recommendation to the Council for suspension of EU funds. Now, the council could decide with a reversed qualified majority voting within 1 month to reject the commission proposal. And in fact, I would expect that if a new, when the new TISA government would be set up, then other finance ministers who eventually decide would indeed give some extra time for the new administration to provide a credible fiscal trajectory. But that would just give time, and clearly the new government will have to revise significantly the fiscal plans. It must include significant fiscal adjustment, because otherwise, even if the rule of law concerns that Heather has spoken about before would be addressed, and therefore the frozen funds would be unlocked, then the funds could be again frozen if the excessive deficit procedure requirements are not fulfilled by the new government in Hungary.
So let's say Hungary does everything it's supposed to do. It claws back these funds after a year or two of hard work and electoral internal fights by the new government. How does the EU's new budget plan, which attempts to change the way cohesion funds and these funds are transferred around Europe, could that then throw another wrench into the system? Or do you think that Hungary, because it's such a relatively poor member of the EU, would be in line to receive funds as long as it does its share of the work?
Hungary would continue to receive sizable funds from the EU budget, not least because its development level is relatively poor and unfortunately deteriorated relative to other Central European countries. On the other hand, the position of the new government at this moment is somewhat unclear of how they would go into the negotiations, because what their program says is that in its current form, the Commission proposal for the next multi-annual budget is unacceptable for them. But there is not much information which element of this proposal is unacceptable. I mean, we can infer that they might, for example, join other countries like France and Poland, who very much dislike the planned reduction in agricultural subsidies. Also in the European Parliament, there are already TISA voters, and for example, they voted against the Mercosur deal because they fear that this would hurt Hungarian voters. So, which I find, I have to say, a somewhat populist approach. I'm very much in favor of trade deals. So at this stage, it's unclear what negotiating strategy they will go for the EU budget negotiations. On the other hand, you know, I give them the trust that they will go there with good faith, and they will indeed try to reach compromises after, you know, debates and, you know, convincing each other what are the interests of different countries and what is the interest of the European Union as a whole. So ultimately, I expect that they would approve the EU budget and would not reject outright, as Mr. Orbán promised that he would do if he stayed in power.
We haven't talked yet about China. They have been a significant source of investment into Hungary. They have been not Russia, which is a point in their favor, but also foreign direct investment in the EU is subject to more concern these days because of all of the economic security threats and considerations on the table. Heather, how do we make sense of that?
I think the key issue about Chinese foreign direct investment in Hungary specifically is lack of transparency. So rather like with the contracts with Russia, what are the conditions? What favors was the government doing in order to get that investment? That's one of the big questions you often hear around the EU. And also there are all kinds of, you know, stories about the investors bringing in Chinese workers and even Chinese concrete to construct factories and not providing a lot of local added value or employment. And that's a concern that's been raised quite a lot, certainly in Brussels. So I think the question is sort of how there's an issue about the added value and what does this mean in terms of the EU's relationship with China, where there's a very confused debate across the board, actually. But then there's this issue about Trojan horses. How far are China's political and economic interests in Europe? Were they being advanced by the Fidesz government? That's the really big question. And how far might that happen through other governments? So the openness of the EU, the various vulnerabilities of the EU with regard to that. And that's not only about FDI, that's also about, for example, the Fudan University in Budapest, the various Chinese cultural centers. There are various forms of issues of influence there. But I think the key problem that the Mojiao government is going to face is all of these constraints that Zsolt was just talking about. You know, they've got this very difficult situation with the budget deficit above 5% of GDP, risk of getting the EU funds refrozen that he just spelled out. And they need to deliver quick wins. You know, this government, after 16 years of a very populist government, which did a lot of things that were popular, for example, in terms of family allowances and so on, he's got to deliver for the public while under these strong fiscal constraints. So it's quite difficult in those circumstances to say no to foreign investment. So I think that's going to be the needle that they will have to thread, is to do those things. And of course, trying to remove the state capture that Fidesz managed to achieve during those 16 years in power. And that's a very hard thing. It takes a long time. It's really difficult to unscramble the egg from the omelet when it comes to removing political appointees from everybody from the state broadcaster to the court, the prosecutors, the public procurement system, local governments. That will take a long time. So there will need to be a lot of reformist zeal in this government. And that could be tricky, especially because Mojiao himself, of course, comes from Fidesz. That was his own political background. And he was married to very prominent Fidesz minister, Judith Varga. He also has, a number of ministers in his government who are also part of Fidesz. So how will he go about this? This is not like 1989, where you had an ancien regime that was thoroughly discredited and everybody associated with it was thrown out and new young reformers came from abroad and from all different places, including, by the way, Viktor Orban himself, who was a young liberal at that point in time. And they came in and they changed the whole system. This is a very different situation where you'll have a lot of hangover from the old system and figures from Fidesz itself who will be involved. So I think the rest of the EU will be looking very carefully at how far the reforms can go ahead in terms of changing systems that have clearly caused both grand corruption, misuse of EU funds, bringing in very dodgy funds from Russia and so on, but also petty corruption, corruption in schools and in hospitals because of very low wages and underfunding of the healthcare and education systems over the years. That's going to be a hell of a job. And it's not as if you've got a completely new government of totally new people doing a clean sweep. They will be having to do a bricolage of many different things under very difficult fiscal constraints.
We are coming to the end of our time. The word that keeps coming to my mind is incredible. It's incredible that the prospects for Hungary's outlook have changed so much in such a short period of time after 16 years of dealing with Orban and these incremental getting closer, pulling away from the EU, the situation with Russia, that now suddenly we're looking at all of these changes and all of this possibility, albeit with all of the challenges and inertia that persist. What else would you like listeners to take away from this, Heather?
Well, first of all, Viktor Orban's legacy is extraordinary. He's perhaps the single person who has most reshaped the EU over the past 16 years, and he's changed it more than Brexit did, which is amazing for a country of 8 million people. And he's done it through a combination of understanding the EU extremely well, playing politics at every level extremely well. You know, he was in the European People's Party for many years and only left it voluntarily. He was never thrown out. And he used that position in the council, Council and in the European Parliament very successfully. He's been really good at going right to the limit of EU law and then just going over, making it hard for the EU lawyers to complain about what he was doing. It's an incredible legacy, and that means that others may seek to follow it. So I think we should remember that that Orbanism may live on, even though Viktor Orban is no longer prime minister. He is, of course, by the way, still an active politician and may well come back to power. Let's not forget he was in power before 2010 as well. He had another term in power. So there could be longevity there. But I think the key thing is that there's also now a big push against Orbanism. There is finally, after 16 years, an understanding of how dangerous this kind of behavior is for the whole EU. There's in the EU treaties, there's this obligation of sincere cooperation of member states. And Orban violated that principle over and over again. So I think there will be stronger reactions to others trying to play that game. People now recognize the playbook and they see where it leads. There are now new rules on the use of EU funds to prevent corruption in the future and in order to hold on to things like the rule of law. So there's also been a reaction that will continue. And finally, the way that Orban really impoverished his country with Hungary starting as an EU member in 2004 in a very good position as the leader of the pack, the best pupil in the class, both in terms of the economy and also in terms of being really part of the EU system and having an outside positive role. And now we're in the opposite situation in 2026. So the way in which the new government and its successors portray the EU in Hungary as a positive force for Hungary's economic development will be really fundamental to whether it's possible for Orbanism to take over again.
Historic moment. Scholz, what would you like to leave listeners with?
Just let me remind everyone that the election was on the 12th of April. And 23 years ago, the referendum on EU membership was exactly on the same day when the majority of a very large majority of Hungarians voted for EU membership. And I also think that the election in this year, this April the 12th, was also a kind of choice between continued EU membership or further drifting away towards Russia, China, and other authoritarian powers. So for me, the main lesson also from the election of Donald Tusk in the end of 2023 is that when a political system within the EU drifts away too much from European values, and even if it seems, you know, very unlikely that regime could be changed, still, you know, some miracles can happen, as it happened in Poland 3 years ago and in Hungary a few days ago, that the majority of population, despite all the propaganda and some fake news, still values membership in the European Union and European values, and can make an end for such regime. So this is the main positive message I would take away from the elections in Hungary.
You've been listening to Zsolt Darvas and Heather Graby from Bruegel. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and this is The Sound of Economics. We are recording on April the 13th, one day after this historic election, and I really appreciate colleagues coming together to make this special episode available for all of our listeners. You can find it for free on all of your favorite podcast platforms, along with our research, Scholz's excellent economic summary of what to look forward to, Heather's work on democracy and justice issues in the EU. We'll be linking to her memo with colleagues to the incoming commission, and of course, the upcoming event on Hungary's prospects for joining the euro at long last. Thank you so much for listening, and we hope to see you next time. Yeah.